Good morning, church. It's really good to be back again, and as was announced, and as you can see, I'm very much up and about. Had three steroid jabs in between my L3 to L5 and S1, and so I think I'm up and about and all looking forward for the church camp. Just want to thank the worship team earlier, who really led us in a very meaningful and uplifting worship, and I trust that we all have been drawn close to the Lord. Now, today's sermon, as you suspect, is closely related and somewhat a continuation from last week. However, it will take a different trajectory in that I will deal with more specific issues on sexuality, like premarital and extramarital sex, on the same-sex attraction and pornography. Now, each of these are actually very big topics and issues in themselves and deserving a sermon or a seminar on its own. I will attempt to, once again, address these issues, both from a biblical and a psychosocial perspective, giving you salient points and hoping that you will be able to hammer it out in your CGs. I told Pastor Daryl and Pastor Kevin, who is overall in charge of these contemporary issues, that you may not have any clear-cut or straightforward answers. It's confusing, and today will be even more confusing. And because of its complexity, and thus the title, Sex is Not So Simple. I'm happy, of course, to dialogue with you a little more after the service or during the church camp, and those of you who are not going, you always have your in-house sociologist, Dr. Alex Lee, as well as your in-house psychiatrist, Dr. Sim Kam, now both of whom are your elders, so good luck to you, my friends. I don't have the latest figures on some specific areas of sexuality, and even if I do, I'm not sure if I want to alarm you or maybe you are already immune from it. It is, for example, no surprise, right, to read of the phenomenal rise of teenage abortions and of the fact that many teens are no longer virgin by the time they get married or on their wedding night. In the U.S., only 7 to 8% of brides and grooms are virgins on their wedding night. The average age of first intercourse in Singapore is about 16.4 years for boys and 15.6 years for girls. Nearly half do not use contraceptives. Now, are we just talking about premarital sex and abortion among teenagers? Of course not. Single and married adults are just as susceptible. Many young adults have sex during their vacationing together. Some are cohabiting before marriage. And for the married ones, our local news report that infidelity is a key reason for 70 to 80% of divorces. I can, of course, testify to this as a marriage counselor. Where pornography is concerned, the numbers are staggering. The websites for porn visits are much more than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined together. 70% of men aged 18 to 24 visit those websites monthly. And 70% of traffic on our mobile phones are actually on porn websites. So we do live in a sexually permissive society, if I could add a sex-saturated and sex-perverted one. Now, someone has said that sex has become one of the most discussed subjects of modern people. People in the Victorian age pretend that it did not exist. We moderns pretend that nothing else exists. One of my former professors at Fuller Seminary, Dr. Lewis Smith, in his book, Sex in the Real World, states that sex is the single most is that the single most powerful sexual stimulant in existence today is the film and the television, and of course, the internet. I could name you many shows where people jump in and out of bed, like with multiple partners, like nobody's business. Sex in the City, Basic Instincts, 50 Shades of Grey, and the sequel, 50 Shades of Freed. And older versions, like Friends with Benefits, and Ally McBeal. Sex sells. Eroticism is a common theme in many American movies. And whether in glossy magazines, over the television, cinemas, music, videos, the internet, they are attractive and addictive. Now, in the light of this, we cannot but look at what the Bible has to say. It may seem antiquated, you know, outdated at first glance, but I hope to show its relevance and its pertinence for today. Now, the passage that I've chosen will anchor and an anchor on is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 that was just read for us. And from here, I hope to extrapolate and apply to several issues of sexuality, drawing some biblical principles and integrate it with some sound psychological insights. Now, in the text before us, Paul begins with a broad principle before getting specifically into the area of sexuality. And so we read here in verse 1, "Finally, brothers, we instruct you on how to live in order to please God." And of course, in the following verses 3 to 8, he zeroes in specifically on how that can be expressed in a life of sexual purity. And then the last two verses, of course, urging us the area of loving one another as a result of our walk with God. Now, let's take a closer look at this verse. Now, two things are not worthy in this verse. First, the emphasis on pleasing God, you know, in order to please God. That's the foundation of Christian morals and Christian ethics. And verse 2, the persuasive or authoritative tone that you know, comes together with it, in which he delivers his concern, in which he just says, "We urge you in the Lord Jesus Christ by the authority of the Lord." And of course, when we read later on in, I think, verse 8, where it says, if you disregard this, you're not disregarding the words of man, but God himself. So you see how important this is. Now, first, from this general principle, Paul goes on specifically to urge the readers to control themselves with regards to sexuality. It's not surprising that he begins here. Why? Now, commentators think that it's for two reasons. First is because it's the most compelling, commanding, or controlling of all human urges. The most compelling, commanding, or controlling of all human urges. And second, because of the moral laxity and the promiscuity of the then Greco-Roman world. Now, you might want to note, or like to note, that when Paul was writing this, he was, this letter to the Thessalonians, he was doing so from Corinth. Now, both cities were well known for their sexual immorality. In Corinth, people worshipped the Greek goddess Aphrodite, the god of sex, who, you know, sent servants out as prostitutes to roam the streets by night. Now, but it just wasn't Corinth or Thessalonica. Actually, most other cities in the then known world were just as promiscuous. And then it was widely accepted that men at that time could not, you know, limit themselves to their wife or as the only sexual partner. But they could have a mistress, a concubine, a substitute, or a playmate while maintaining the wife to manage the household and you know, caring for their legitimate children. Now, from this general principle and motivation in verses 1 and 2, Paul goes on to the specific injunction in verse 3, where it says, it's God's will that you should be holy or sanctified, and that you should avoid sexual immorality. Now, the word avoid in our NIV is too weak. The word is too weak. The New Testament scholar, Howard Marshall, rightly comments, he says that when things are evil, the Christian attitude is necessarily one of abstention and not of moderation. In other words, it's not just a matter of avoiding. It entails a clear cut, you know, to have nothing to do with it. Don't play around with it or you'll get burned, Paul is saying. That reminds me of that famous movie, Fatal Attraction, where a man, Michael Douglas, had a one-night stand with a woman, Glenn Close, and thereafter suffered harassment and hell. Now, from this prohibition, Paul goes on to lay two fundamental practical principles to guide us in our sexual behavior. And they also give the reasons for this prohibition. The next verse, it says that each of you should control his body in a way that is holy and honorable. Now, there is a dual interpretation and application here. The first is that for all of us, married or unmarried, you know, to be able to control our body, our sexuality, in a way that is holy and honorable. I think that's quite straightforward. We will not allow it to be used other than its intended purpose. And this purpose or context is found in the second interpretation. Now, the second interpretation, which most commentators favor, is that this verse, which, by the way, is the most difficult phrase to interpret in this epistle, you know, in the original Greek language, that it should literally be translated as, each one of you should acquire his own vessel in holiness and honor. Now, what is this vessel that Paul is referring to? It could refer to the body, as is translated in our NIV, as well as KJV. But the RSV has it as wife. So it reads that each of you should know how to take a wife for himself, or acquire a wife for himself. Now, that might sound demeaning, right, for a wife to be referred to as a vessel. But this was accepted in Judaism as a euphemism. Euphemism means an inoffensive way of putting things. Now, the majority of modern commentators, including my favorite, John Stock, take it to mean this. That is, verse 4, to be translated, that each of you should acquire his own wife in holiness and honor. If so, then the implication is very clear, that sex has a God-given context, that is, a heterosexual marriage. Paul is affirming a heterosexual marriage as the only God-given context for sexual intercourse. So the implication, no premarital or extramarital sex, no homosexual or lesbian activities. And the only context for sexual intercourse is within marriage, a heterosexual and a monogamous one, which is holy and honorable. Now that I have attempted to give us the context, we can now proceed to flesh it out in terms of the sexual issues of our day. And there are four that I said I will try to deal with: premarital, extramarital, pornography, and homosexuality. We will begin with premarital sex, applicable to both singles and courting couples. As alluded at the beginning, it's increasingly difficult to keep oneself sexually pure or as a virgin before marriage. With the visual sexual stimulation all around us, the examples we see in our friends and even in our heroes, maybe the actors and actresses that we look up to, with regular vacationing in many holidays destinations, and with the urge for instant gratification, what feels good, I think we are all very susceptible to premarital sex. But here are some hard facts for us to face head on. Even though pleasure and enjoyment may be so-called good reasons why people get involved sexually, we need to consider the potential harm for your partner, for yourself, and the particular relationships. Now, here are some pertinent questions that we have to think through. Will either of us get hurt by the sexual behavior that we engage at this time? Are we emotionally ready to deepen our relationship at this level? Am I mature enough or ready to make a covenant commitment to this person? Now, what happens if either of us want out after we become sexually intimate, which, by the way, is not uncommon? Will the emotional pain of breaking up after being this involved cause either of us psychological harm, maybe guilt and shame thereafter? What happens if a pregnancy occurs? Would we be able or willing to care for this child? I could go on and on, but I think you get the idea, don't you? I recall counseling a couple quite a few years ago, both in their 20s, been engaging in frequent sex without contraceptives. She got pregnant twice and had 2 abortions. They applied for the HDB flat and were waiting for it. But guess what happens? He decided to call it a day. And what do you think, and how do you think she felt at the end of the day? I think she probably felt like something like that. The discarded, ragged doll, dirty, soiled, and abandoned. That's what may happen. Now, the point of these questions is to keep friendship and relationship in focus and to assume mutual responsibility for it. Will sexual involvement or sexual intercourse enhance or take away, from committed love in the near or in the far future? And as we ask this question, we'll also be looking more realistically at the potential complications that can come about when we are sexually involved before marriage. Biblical norms for sexual intercourse aren't meant to deprive one of sexual pleasure, but to ensure the sanctity of the union embedded in the deeply satisfying covenant relationships. Biblical norms about sexual intercourse aren't meant to deprive one of sexual pleasure, but to ensure the sanctity of the union embedded in the deeply satisfying covenant relationship. I believe it's also possible for human sexual energy to be redirected into healthy diversions like exercise and education, travels and hobbies, as well as close relationships with both friends of both sexes. There are many Christian singles who can testify to this. And I think one classic example, a great example here, is none other than our brother John Lee, who wrote an excellent article in last week's bulletin on the 4 D's of living well as a single: define, discern, desire, and devote. It's a must-read article, and I ask that all of you would do so. Together, of course, with the spiritual exercises, that very good questions that was posed by Pastor Don, and today again, a couple of questions on sexual chastity. Now, sex, we say, has a God-given context, that is, within marriage. But not only that, it's also the manner or way in which it should be conducted. Now, back to the same verse that we read, you know, earlier on, where it says, each of you should learn to control his body or acquire his own wife in a way that is honorable and holy, not in passionate lust, like the heathen who do not know God. That marriage is a God-given context for sexual intercourse does not mean that within marriage there's no need for restraint. Now, you have probably heard or even experienced the selfish sexual demands made by one married partner on the other in terms of aggression, manipulation, violence, cruelty, and even rape. As John Stott puts it, marriage is not a form of legalized lust. Marriage is not a form of legalized lust. So what Paul is saying here is that it's possible to wrong or take advantage of each other, or as verse 6 puts it, that in this manner you should not wrong the brother or take advantage of him. Now, this sounds as though we wrong our brother by coveting, you know, or being sexually involved with his wife. Now, that's a possible interpretation. Though the point, I believe, is that Paul is saying is that taking advantage of each other within marriage or outside of marriage is incompatible with a holy and honorable sexual behavior. The fact is that there is a difference, a world of difference between lust, passionate lust, as Paul puts it, and love. Between sexual practices that uses the partner and true love that honors the partner with, you know, cherishing and respecting him or her. You know, unfortunately, we see so much of this so-called love today is none other than lust, or to put it in another way, kind of sexploitation. Now, at this point, when we are talking about lust, it can take place within marriage, what John Stott calls legalized lust, but we can also extend it to lust outside of marriage, that is, infidelity or extramarital affairs. And last, in terms of pornography and sexual addiction. Now, let's begin with infidelity. Now, there are many reasons why men and women are prone to infidelity. I can't be comprehensive here, but here are some major contributions of our vulnerability towards infidelity. It could be, It could be the state of the union, the marital situation, you know, in which the state of the union is in disarray, disintegrating from disappointment with each other because of unmet needs and unfulfilled expectation. It can lead to a deep sense of disillusionment. Inevitably, there's a good measure of sexual incompatibility and dissatisfaction, both the quantity and the quality of sex. Then also, there is inequity or a sense of unfairness or injustice, be it in emotional investment of the relationship, in household chores, or in child minding. Inevitably, one party is over-functioning and the other is under functioning. Not that uncommon, isn't it? Now, invariably, we should also add communication problems, you know, tons of misunderstanding due to lack of clarity or specificity, a lack of good listening and empathy, not being heard, and therefore being hurt. You know, in communication, one's words can be toxic, you know, spiteful or provocative. Or in conflict, that may be what we call relationship dances, in which one party is the pursuer and the other party, the withdrawer or the distancer, one like a shark and the other like a turtle. A struggle for power and control is also a common theme. Who has the biggest say or has the last say? On an individual level, one person is probably running on empty, tired, lonely, bored, or angry. There's a need to boost up, you know, his ego or her need for love and affection. Now, I could list many other push factors, you know, be it in-laws, interference, money, addiction problems, or increasingly many couples are living separate lives, you know, or parallel lives in which they have set of activities and friends that don't intersect. And coming back to this area of ego, there could be a sense of entitlement or narcissism. And quoting Dr. Lewis Mitz again, he terms such a one as a self-maximizer. And this is his description. A self-maximizer, he says, is one who evaluates relationship with others in terms of what he or she can get and how his or her needs can be met. Now, such person turns life into a quest for happiness. And if the spouse doesn't bring it, he turns to others to fulfill that need. And if an extramarital affair promises more than what he's getting in a marriage, he will go for it. Why stick with what you are stuck with? Perhaps a sniffling and out-of-shape spouse when there are bright and beautiful people out there waiting to have your companionship and fun. Why face a nagging and demanding wife when at the office there are people who adore and admire you? So these are the factors and dynamics that can make one vulnerable to extramarital affairs. I'm sure we can identify a few, if not all of them. And if so, I urge you to do something about it, from taking efforts and even money to cultivate and to reconstruct your marriage, to seeking help from marriage mentors or professionals, so that you don't go down this slippery road of infidelity. By the way, may I be quick to also add that the fifth commandment has to do with thou shalt not commit adultery. And Jesus went on further by stating that looking lustfully at the woman is as good as committing adultery. And I should also add that the straying eyes are not only the men. There's increasing number of women with straying eyes too. Now, I wish we had time to look at how we can strengthen and build our marital relationship, which are the best means of countering this vulnerability. I certainly hope you would do so among yourself as a couple and in your CGs. Meanwhile, we have to deal with another sexual deviation or lust, which manifests itself in pornography or sexual addiction. Now, the Greek word for pornography is porne, meaning female captives, and under its original meaning, it's the use of sex for subjugation, aggression, degradation, abuse, coercion, violence, dominance, control, sadism, or rape. Now, today's contemporary use has a much broader meaning, including sexually explicit art, literature, and film. And of course, this has led to relativism in determining and defining, you know, what constitutes pornography, because pornography is in the eyes of the beholder. Now, you might like to know in terms of figures that there are 26 million porn websites and 2.3 billion web pages on porn. And why is it so impactful? I think we all know the four A's, right? Because it's available, accessible, affordable, and anonymous. But I think we should add three more A's. It's appealing, it's aggressive, and it's addictive. The most important thing that we need to know about pornography is that it always dehumanizes. That is used to degrade others, and we believe that dehumanization is a violation of the value God places on human life and sexuality. Therefore, it's both offensive and unacceptable. The tragic effects of dehumanization process involves the objectification for sexual stimulation. Now, some people argue that the effect of viewing pornography is positive. It helps to normalize, it helps to normalize aggressive sexual urges and contribute to the release of aggressive feelings, thus preventing inappropriate sexual behavior. However, recent research do not support this cathartic view. Evidence actually points in the exact opposite direction, suggesting that pornography instead increases, sexually aggressive urges and attitudes of men and women. And three researchers by the name of Allen, D'Alessio, and Bregel analyzed 30 lab studies on the effect of exposure to pornography and concluded that sexually aggressive behaviors were induced by pictorial nudity, by material depicting both violent and non-violent sexual activity. Further, these viewers had a more callous attitude about sexual violence towards women and rape victims and were more likely to commit sexually violent acts if they were not be caught. So these people had the so-called primary effect, in which they believed that what they believe were reinforced by what they watch, and this in turn influences sexual arousal and desensitization, desensitizing the viewers about dehumanizing human sexuality. And the process also led to rationalizing in minimizing the protest of women against sexual aggression. In other words, they both begin to objectify sexual aggression and justify it by saying that women themselves invite or desire sexual aggression. Now, other researchers have also shown that those who engage in sexual behavior have been high consumers of pornography. So it's safe to conclude that though viewing pornography may not cause sexual aggression, it is a significant factor in the attitudes towards sexual aggression and behavior. A final hazard I just quickly highlight here is that pornography normally leads to addiction. The visual erotic content can be seared into the memory and images of this graphic erotica that are difficult to erase. I recall when I was secondary one, 57 years ago, I was shown pictures of nude women and acts of intercourse. And do you know what? I can recall them like that. It's hidden somewhere in my brain. Even after 57 years, it's seared somewhere at the back of my brain. Erotic materials seem to be especially tempting and influential to men who are more visual. Though I reckon that women are more into it, and even pastors, by the way, are not exempted from it. I counseled two pastors, and I know of another pastor who are struggling with it. Maintaining purity, as is our trust for today's sermon, is particularly challenging and a constant battle. Today's world, where there is a deluge of mass media seeking to control our minds, it is important then, I think, to admit the problem and to resist further exposure to dehumanizing material. Then too, I think we need to choose to eliminate and to monitor these images that come by. I mean, in some ways, it's hard to keep these images, which are in a lot of places. But I think it's possible to choose to eliminate or monitor these fantasies in our mind, and we have to take responsibility for our thoughts and our fantasy. And we can decide how long and what to do with the images, to take it captive and to take responsibility. And finally, I believe that we need to confess it before the Lord, before a brother or sister, and put ourselves into accountability if we are into this. Now, a short while ago, I mentioned the Greek word for pornography is porne, meaning female captives, which is the word used for sex, for subjugation, aggression, so on and so forth. The same root word is also used in the context of divorce, where Jesus was confronted by the religious rulers as to the grounds of divorce in both Matthew 19 and Mark 10. And there he stated that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness or porneia, and marries another, commits adultery. Now, this same word, porneia, is used, to denote all kinds of sexual immorality, not just adultery, all kinds of things that are indecent and illicit, not just adultery. But of course, it does include quite a few things. It could include, as you see up here, rape, incest, bestiality, pedophilia, prostitution, and homosexuality. Now, secular societies of ancient times recognized adultery as a legitimate ground for divorce. Hence, it's not surprising that porneia is often interpreted as adultery, even though it has all this wider meaning. And this brings me to the most sensitive and the most delicate of all sexual issues today, none other than homosexuality and same-sex attraction, or SSA. I'm first to and will freely admit that I'm no expert in this matter, and also to give the remaining 5 minutes or less will not do justice to the controversies and complexities. It's also not best to deal on this topic over the pulpit where it is only a one-way traffic. And I trust that you guys have had or will have, a dialogue on this by an expert. I'm happy to recommend you some names, which will be much more fruitful than these few minutes that I have left. But allow me to give it a shot, and do forgive me for my deficiencies. There are many theories and explanations to homosexuality, and we can boil down to two basic perspectives. One is biological factors, and two, psychosocial factors or nature. Psychosocial explanations can further be divided into two other areas, social learning theories, as well as new psychoanalytical theory. Now, this pulpit is not a place to teach psychology and to use psychological lingo. But let me try to put it in layman's language and simplify it as much as possible, hopefully not being too simplistic. Now, social learning theories, in essence, has to do with the lack or the deprivation of inadequate or negative experiences that one has with the opposite sex parent. Now, it can also be attributed to this adolescent state whereby after puberty, each gender becomes more interested in the opposite sex. However, for some, they still remain in this so-called homosocial stage of being interested only in the same sex for whatever reason. That's where they develop a homosexual orientation. In psychoanalytical theory, which is a bit more complicated, but it's a very popular and widely accepted explanation, this happens during the ages of 4 to 6, when children work through what is called the Oedipus or the Electra complexes and become confused about their sexual identity. Now, this complexes, again, has to do with certain deficiencies in the parent-child relationship, but this time it emerges out of you know, deficits in a child relationship with the parents of the same sex. Unlike the earlier one, it's a parent of the opposite sex, but this one is the deficiency in the parent of the same sex. Now, you see, parents are the normal sources of love and affection, you know, but when it is withheld, replaced with absence or distance, or worse still, with anger and hostility, this same gender child will experience what they call an intrapsychic damage at a very deep level. He or she then grows up as a youth or young adult with this unmet parent love need, which he then compulsively seeks to meet this need through erotic means with a person of the same sex. It's a kind of compensation for what is missing or deficient in the childhood. Sounds confusing, isn't it? I told you this is going to be more confusing than the last week's sermon. But in summary, what I would say is that is the biological and social, psychosocial factors contribute independently and interactively to the nature of a child's sexual development, which in turn contributes to certain orientation or desire. But the key question is whether a person decides to act or not act on these desires. We are not merely passive agents like pawns of a biological and psychological influences. We are choice-making people, creatures through whom the process of moral development is cultivated. We are not merely passive agents like pawns of a biological and psychosocial influences, but we are choice-making creatures. Now, this involves, of course, learning and understanding the meaning of sexuality in both in a social context and from a Christian and biblical perspective. There are a good number of passages, biblical passages, that deal with sexuality in general, like this one that we are looking at, but also specifically, there are 5 specific references to homosexual behaviors. Now, the Bible makes no definite statement about homosexuality as an orientation, but only to homosexual behaviors. And even these references are hotly debated by the Christian community as they come, you know, to widely different ethical and moral positions. As you suspect, I won't have time to deal with any of this, and my time is already up, and I ask that you would forgive me. But let me end with a couple of things that I believe could be helpful for all of us who are in different categories. For those who are married, cultivate a strong and healthy ongoing relationship with your spouse. Take care of your own and your spouse's emotional and sexual needs. Do not divorce sex from a loving and caring relationship. Proverbs 5, verses 15 to 20 is an excellent passage that I ask all couples here to read and to discuss, and please do so today or the next few days. For the singles and those who are not yet married, establish clear boundary lines for your friendship and of the opposite sex. Don't give or encourage wrong signals. Proverbs 6:27 and 28 says that, can a man scoop fire in his lap without his clothes being burned? Or walk on hot coals without his feet being scorched? Or as a Nigerian proverb puts it, what you don't eat, don't smell. For all of us, married or unmarried, live a holy life, as the gist of the message. Warn yourself of the disastrous consequences of sexual immorality. Redeem and recover idle time and thought. Don't give yourself opportunity to loiter into sin. As you have heard it say, an idle mind is a devil's workshop. And Proverbs 7:7-9 gives a picture of sexual sin as somebody with a vacant mind and time to spare, you know, a person who is naive and lacks judgment and discernment. It's also important for all of us to understand your own sexuality Get in touch with the way how your system works, your desires, your vulnerabilities. Recognize your own ego and unmet needs. And take time, you know, and effort to protect and to overcome this. Now, I'm quite sure that there's much more that you can add, you know, in your talk and discussion with your spouse and in your care group. Finally, let me say that we all need the wisdom of each other. We need God's help for wisdom, protection, and the courage to deal with this pertinent issue, because sex is not so simple. Let us pray. Now, Father and God, we thank you for this time, even though slightly hurried because of so many things to cover, Lord, and so many areas that are pertinent. Yet, Lord, we ask that you will use these things that have been laid as clearly as possible, and that your Spirit will continue to work in our hearts, in our minds, in our lives, Lord, to enable us to live lives that are holy and honorable to you. For this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.